footage of Pauline Boaty.
You should be talking about Pauline Boaty when you talk about pop art. She should always be in the same sentence as Warhol, Blake. You know, she is an absolute innovator.
She was having fun, like the rest of the pop artists.
She was just there for that brief minute.
Boaty's work confronted female desire and female lust.
She and her work had so many of the best characteristics of the 1960s. Fun, political, colourful, original, thoughtful, and unfortunately short-lived as well.
She's just, I don't know, she's a star.
Boaty, I Am the 60s. London, 1st of July 2023. A blue plaque is unveiled on the house that Pauline Boaty lived and worked in, 7A Addison Avenue, London, W11.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The blue plaque for Pauline Boaty, pop art pioneer, feminist and actor. Artist Sir Peter Blake, CBE.
We're here because a plaque has been unveiled for Pauline Boaty. We were very close friends. We were in a film together that Ken Russell made, and I was in love with her, deeply in love with her.
As children, we used to run around and play on her paintings. They were all up in my nana's attic, and we just used to make camps with them and things. And now to see them up in galleries and we're selling for so much money is extraordinary, but it's lovely.
It's great to see women in art being celebrated, especially from the 60s. And Pauline played a big part in the pop art movement, and I think it went by a bit unnoticed.
To have this incredible voice, just this vibrant, alive woman and youthful presence to be coming back into our consciousness is a wonderful thing. I think her importance is just going to grow and grow.
Singer Tanita Tikaram.
I Am the 60s. You just didn't realise. This is London, the last train to Coshalton. All sleepy suburbs.
Monologues written by Vinnie Rording, taken from his radio play The Last Days of Pauline Boaty. Dr. Sue Tate, writer and art historian.
On the surface, it would appear to be a very conventional sort of upbringing in suburban South London. Her dad was an accountant, her mum was a housewife. But when you look below the surface a little, it was actually slightly more unusual. Her dad was in fact half Persian. His mother was Persian and his father was Belgian.
Pauline's father came over from Persia. His father had died and his mother didn't really want him and his brother around, so they were sent over here to be educated.
Her mum, the story reverberates through the family that her father wouldn't let her take up a place at the Slade, and she always resented it. And I think she gave Pauline a lot of support. She would shout at the radio sometimes, apparently, it's a man's world, which may be where Pauline got the title for her later painting.
She loved Pauline because she was the only daughter.
She very much wanted to go to art school and had terrible rows with her father. He really didn't want her to go.
Her mum, I think, wanted to be a painter. Her dad was very conventional. And she broke away. You know, she went into the city. She came into town. She went to Wimbledon School of Art, first of all, where everybody kind of fell in love with her in their masses.
First of all, she went into painting, but it was very old-fashioned, drab, brown sort of paintings. And she switched to study under Charles Carey because he was young, dynamic. He ran the stained glass school. He was very sympathetic to women. He was critical of the misogyny of some of the other staff. She visited Paris and made work influenced by Cubism, by Bonnard, by Leger. She left hugely confident and went to the Royal College of Art. And there, things rather changed.
The carved college crest in archive footage.
I'm the Bardo of Wimbledon, sitting here all alone and trembling. And it's still a man's world.
Louisa Buck, writer and critic.
She only got into the Royal College in the stained glass workshop because it was such a ragingly sexist place that, you know, it was really difficult for women to get in. They had a very small female intake.
Derek Bouchier, Pop Art Contemporary.
She was told that she should apply for the stained glass department because it was tougher to get into the painting school, I think, than any other department at the time.
Everyone met in the canteen in Cromwell Road. So I got to know Pauline quite quickly and we seemed to have a lot in common. And she was just a really vivacious, alive girl.
She is told by one of the lecturers at the Royal College of Art that you're a lovely blonde girl, you're just there to be a bit of decoration for the boys. Women just weren't taken that seriously in those days.
Kathy Unsworth, writer and journalist.
What she encountered was institutional sexism. And that would be true of all education at the time. I'm not saying that Royal College was particular, it was typical.
There was a lot of misogyny there, if you like. I mean, it was a very difficult time. It was the late 50s, early 60s, and it was a woman in a man's world. You really got to understand how tough that must have been.
The ideal art college should be when all the departments integrate. And in fact, that happened at the Royal College at the time.
Textile designer Natalie Gibson.
I don't think we realised what an amazing time it was, you know, for us to be there all at the same time.
There was a great spirit of camaraderie amongst students.
She was in the hub of the 60s, that incredible generation of, you know, Hockney, Bouchier, Peter Blake, and her. And she was in that scene, she epitomised that scene.
I think we'd gone for a walk near Hennecke's pub, which is where we all used to meet on a Saturday afternoon. And this guy in a maroon jacket, corduroy jacket, I don't know, we had some aura about him or something about him. And I said to her, who's he? Pauline said, oh, that's David Hockney. In fact, the painting she did of me, there's a piece on the painting of David Hockney, who I'd never met that time.
She definitely was serious about what she was doing, far more than most of the others. I mean, I was going from one department to another and not really taking myself very seriously. She was more committed and definitely aiming for success somewhere.
She totally engaged. She was a leading figure in the anti-ugly movement.
She came up with this anti-ugly society, and I remember going on couple of the marches.
So the anti-uglies was a group of students that began protesting against certain buildings. They're not against modern architecture, they're actually all in favour of it. They're in a way more impatient with architects building replica-esque buildings of Georgian properties.
Pauline was much more involved in that than I was, but I did go. My best memory of that was going to marching on the barracks in Hyde Park. We were in Hyde Park Corner and there's a shop called Bazaar, Mary Quant's shop, and this very tall, sort of modelly-looking woman stepped out and she sort of looked at this motley crew and she said, oh, but you're all so ugly yourselves.
Colour film of Pauline Reading.
This is London. I am art. You just overanalyzed. You're all just catching up.
Once she left the Royal College of Art, there were two, three things that happened, I think, that gave her back her confidence. One was that Charles Carey, her tutor from Wimbledon, put together an exhibition at the AIA Gallery in London alongside three other artists, including Peter Blake, who was yet to have a solo exhibition himself. And it's been welcomed as the first ever pop show. She showed a number of collages and a couple of abstract paintings. Then there was Pop Goes the Easel.
Good evening. Our programme tonight consists of one single film that we've made about four young artists.
Russell presents to Hugh Weldon an idea that he's going to write about this new art phenomenon, pop art. And, you know, Weldon has to be persuaded to do this. He's a bit sceptical initially.
There are four painters who turn for their subject matter to the world of pop art, the world of the popular imagination, the world of film stars, the twist, science fiction, pop singers, A world which you can dismiss if you feel so inclined, of course, as being tawdry and second-rate, but a world all the same, in which everybody, to some degree anyway, lives, whether we like it or not.
Pop Goes the Easel airs in 1962, and it stars Peter Phillips, Pauline Boaty, Peter Blake and Derek Brashear. And it's a kinetic, lively look at these four artists.
Travis Elber, a writer and cultural commentator. Footage of the artists and others dancing the twist, then Derek Brashear.
It was Peter and Ken Russell who got their heads together. I understand he picked Pauline first and then picked myself and Peter Phillips later. Ken Russell picked on different personas for each of the four of us. Pauline, of course, was depicted as this, the Brigitte Bardot of Wimbledon, as some terrible journalist called her. And that he took on that aspect of her.
Wonder story.
Who's this, Pauline?
Come on. Oops.
Natalie
Wood
from Splendid
in
the Grass.
What
doesn't
look like Natalie Wood,
didn't Pop Goes the Easel, that I'd heard, and them having a, getting up in the morning and having, doing what pop artists do all day, and then going to a party for a disco. And it just looked like it was fun, not serious, deadly, earnest art. It was just like, this is fun. And I think that was quite a British thing. So it was all very British, all that whole movement, not like the American pop artists who took it all a bit too seriously. And to be honest, we did it first. The British did it first. And they just sort of like jumped on the bandwagon. And it looked like, the factory looked like less fun than Pop Goes the Easel to me.
There's one section where Pauline actually talks about her work, which is very, very interesting. And she talks, the sequence is she talks for Peter Blake.
Who's that? They're
1930 debutantes or 20 debutantes.
It looks like Free Mum. It's sweet, isn't it?
That's one of those Rubens babies.
That was marvellous because I own the piece that she talks about. This is the piece that she talks about.
There's the collage picture show, which is this knowing play on words, because picture show is a magazine about film, and it was quite a lowbrow, mass-produced magazine. But she's playing with the idea to picture show is also an exhibition. At that point, she didn't really have a body of overtly pop work.
You've got Proust, you've got Marilyn. It's got to be one of the earliest times that she was referenced.
It's this intellectual side and the mass culture side.
And that's, what's that?
That's the finger pointing at you.
The bomb.
And a finger pressing the button, which she was very aware were Freudian symbols.
That's Beethoven's pen. And there's Franklin D. Roosevelt growing older. They're badges, actually, they were.
In the pre-production interview, she talked about Freudian symbolism and the meanings of these collages, but that didn't get into the movie. But what she did do was act out her own nightmare, and apparently it was very much her own idea.
Speaking German, a woman approaches, stepping on pictures laid out across the floor. Then Pauline slaps her. Pauline runs.
It's supposedly based on a dream she had where she's pursued by this German woman and then a woman in a wheelchair with sunglasses on. So she sort of runs along corridors as if it's preempting repulsion by, with Catherine Deneuve and Roman Polanski. It's a sort of rather sinister sequence.
Reaching a lift, Pauline pushes buttons and the doors open. Inside, her relief then turns to shock as the woman in the wheelchair appears in the lift behind her. From Pauline backcombing her blonde hair to comedy writer and musician Jason Hazley.
This is an artist, but this is an artist also putting in a performance in a way that Peter Blake really isn't in that film. And she was aware of that, and I think she used it very well.
I've always had very vivid dreams, and I can remember them very, very easily. And I've used the kind of atmosphere of the dreams in my collages. I think there are two things about this. And one is that I often take the moment before something has actually happened, and you don't know if it's going to be terrible or it might be very funny. The other thing is that something very extraordinary is actually happening and yet everyone around isn't taking any notice of it at all.
It doesn't take you 5 minutes to fall in love with Pauline Boaty on screen, because she is just... she is the essence of 60s pop art. And it's all in black and white and her work is very colourful, but the essence comes through.
It was the first acted documentary. We were actors, we act, but we acted ourselves.
Derek Bouchier.
People wrote in, apparently people wrote in and said they weren't going to pay their television licence. What is this rubbish? Because they were used to monitors, you know, highfalutin cultural programmes on opera singers and the fine arts, you know.
Black and white film footage shows the artists browsing market stalls on a city street. One smokes a cigarette while another takes a horror comic called Creepy from a rack.
In the film Pop Goes the Easel, you'll see we go up to a house where she's got a room that she paints and lives in. And I had a room next door to her. So when I was in working and she was working, I saw her every day for coffee. So I talked a lot more about paintings then than I ever did at the Royal College.
My first recollections of her is really in Addison Road. I had a room on the first floor and Pauline had a room on the first floor, but she had one onto the back of the garden. Mine was north-facing, was a bit gloomy. She had a collage wall with all wonderful photographs, all put together brilliantly, told a big story. It was over quite a big expanse, really.
There was just such an amazing, varied collection of, I mean, everything from 16th, 15th century Japanese screens up to, there's a Peter Blake image, there's a David Hockney image, there's Belmondo, there's Monica Vitti, there's Marilyn. So it's a real mixture of film stars and high art and low art. I think back to my bedroom wall, you know, when I was that kind of age, and there was certainly no kind of high art in there at all. I just thought it was a fascinating collection.
The work that Pauline is photographed in Pop Goes the Easel is not pop art. It's Art Nouveau. It's not pop art. Her great pop art paintings came a year later.
A collection of colourful works, including an image of crime boss Jim Colosimo, actress Monica Vitti's face inside a love heart, and a smiling Marilyn Monroe. Kate Bryan, art historian, curator and broadcaster.
I think one of the reasons why pop art still resonates today and still remains such a popular period in art history is that it speaks to all of us, and it speaks to media, it speaks to contemporary culture around us. You know, it was talking about, like, your grandmother could like the same thing that you could like. That's kind of the first time in culture in history that had happened.
What it has in common with punk, right, is that punk was an attempt to reinvent using whatever was lying around. That's exactly what the British pop art scene was as well. It was literally, I'm going to cut things out and stick them in here. Which is precisely the same thing, that's what hip hop was as well. That was like, I'm going to take all these bits of other people's stuff and make new stuff out of it. It's a format which keeps working.
Well, when I was at art school, I used to, that was what I used to really love. And I don't know what it was. I suppose it's just the popness of it, but it was Peter Blake, Derek Bouchier, Hockney and Pauline Boaty, but that was the kind of direction I went. I mean, I've never really stopped, really. It's all about pop imagery. That's Elvis Presley with a ski mask on. That's Clint Eastwood with his bespectacled rabbit with bright day glow red arms. Beyonce on a tiny horse in the caravan park. It's kind of taking icons, pop icons, and putting them in situations that might not ever happen. Winston Churchill with two herring gulls. You see, I've got two there, not one. I've got two. Yeah, that's pop art for you.
Jim Moyer, comedian and artist. Then footage of crowded pavements and yellow taxis.
The idea that America is the future is a kind of key element to all of these pop art things. But in Britain, also mingles with a strange nostalgia and a playful dressing up element.
These were kids who grew up in austerity, grim old 1950s. They were post-war kids, so they looked across the Atlantic to America. They looked across to consumerism, to capitalism, and it started to filter into the UK.
She introduces sexism and feminism into paintings. That's why I wanted to see them so much. I was like, this is a person I wish I knew. This is a person I wish I could go down the pub with.
She offers an interesting counterpoint to even within Pop Goes the Easel, to the sort of male view of pop art and what art should be about. She also is important in the sense of embracing and playing with the iconography of femininity, with people like Marilyn Monroe. It's hard now, in a sense, to even get your head around, I think, what an enormous star Monroe was. They all have their sort of weird Monroe obsessions.
We all love Marilyn Monroe. I remember it being on the cover of Life magazine, not her painting, the photograph. And that's where the painting came from. It's gorgeous.
I'm a bit of a sucker for a suicide blonde, tragic blonde kind of story. It starts with Marilyn Monroe, doesn't it? I mean, those sentiments are echoed as well in Pauline's work. You have, you know, the only blonde in the world, and you just think, is that Pauline? Is it Marilyn? It's echoes of those girls that go out and get themselves in trouble. You know, they've got fur coats falling off, and they're tripping into the night, and you just don't know where they're going to end up. There's a little bit of every blonde that ever was that has a story to tell.
I think my favourite's probably the one that's in the Tate, The Only Blonde in the World, which is such a great image of Marilyn Monroe on the move. And it's got that sort of blurry brush stroke, which I really like. And she looks like if she comes through a door or so, there's just two blocks of colour either side of it. And it is a great image.
The whole painting's falling apart. It's like the world in which she's living in is falling apart. There's no steady ground beneath her feet. Again, she's playing around with all these abstract passages. So is this like a pop-up pin-up? No, not really. There's no pin-up about it. This is not like a singular image, which is where someone's able to be lauded. You know, what's actually happening is that she's putting her in a really unstable territory. And I love the way it's painted. You know, it's like a painted collage. It's a bit mucky. It's a bit naive in places. It's a bit amateurish in places, all purposely done. She doesn't present this to us in any believable space. This is not outside. This is not inside. This is not a stage. This is very much Boti's imagination. You know, you're in this psychological space. So to see Boti as a young woman painting this absolute star, the only blonde in the world, in this psychological space, makes for a really powerful proto-feminist painting.
One of the top critics at the time, who had made abstract expressionism famous across the globe, was Greenberg, and he argued that paintings should always be flat. You shouldn't have perspective, you shouldn't have story. And I believe that she was... It was a kind of joke that you take an abstract, you push it open and you see through, you get depth. And on one side in the abstract, there are three diagonal bands of colour. And at the top corner of one of them, there's a trompe l'oeil effect of turning the corner down, and behind it you see the raw canvas. So it's very layered painting, and I think it's a very clever painting.
It's all painterly, no collage, and she approaches it with a more subtle, sort of sensuous approach, rather than this sort of pin-up. She's not a pin-up in that painting. It's a portrait, in a way.
These are individuals she's painting. They're not just kind of bland, you know, 60s pin-ups. They're pin-ups with her emotional investment into them. I think that's really important. I think her work was very autobiographical in an oblique way. And I always think, you know, The Only Blonde in the World is a portrait of her as much as it's a portrait of Marilyn. I really believe that.
Cherry red bee-stung lips are all the better to kiss you with. Life is sweet, but I'm travelling faster than you.
Film of Pauline smoking a cigarette.
It's incredible now to look at Boti's work through the prism of our 21st century obsession with celebrity. You know, celebrity as a word was really new in the 60s. And the idea that Marilyn Monroe was this kind of like tragic ultimate pinup is so common to us now. But that's like a startling thought for them to have been having then.
She was heartbroken when Marilyn died, absolutely heartbroken, and very quickly painted Colour Her Gone.
She obviously felt a kinship with her. There's this kind of, like, you know, beautiful blonde, but she also understands the darkness that pervades a life like that. And she also understands the limitations, you know, that you can be put on a pedestal as this beautiful blonde, but actually the pedestal will be used to be the thing that is used to drag you down. And in that painting, Colour Her Gone, you know, her face is kind of emerging and also disappearing at the same time. There are these abstract passages either side. Because of the flowers, it looks like a memorial painting. So we think about this through the prism of Monroe's kind of grisly ending. But also the way that it's memorialized is not very joyful. The color palette's all really reduced. So you're kind of looking at this painting, you're saying, am I supposed to be in love with this pinup? Am I supposed to be fetishizing her? Am I supposed to be, you know, putting her on a pedestal? Is she the ultimate celebrity? Or am I supposed to be thinking of her as this kind of quite twee English country garden subject? Like, she sort of removes a lot of the glamour somehow in the way that she paints it. I've always read those abstract passages as something really disruptive. You know, they seem like they're almost like framing her like a piece of pop art, but actually they don't hold her steady. They don't anchor her. They don't really help the portrait in any way. It's not remotely a traditional portrait. I mean, this is really Boaty playing around with the picture plane. It's disruptive, it's unexpected, it's got a lot of levels to it. And I think it's one of those paintings that I keep coming back to, and the older I get and the more I know about the tragedy of Monroe and the tragedy of Boaty, the more darker it gets as an image. It's a fantastically clever composition.
Pauline depicted on film. White with blonde bobbed hair, she holds up handwritten numbers on a large pad, counting down from 5 to 1. Then a band is playing as people dance in a crowded pink-lit studio under a glitter ball.
Pauline and I got invited to Ready, Steady, Go.
Pauline was invited to be a dancer on the very first edition of it. So again, the sense of absolute engagement with popular culture. She wasn't standing outside it, she was absolutely engaged. She made a painting about it. So the top of the painting has 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then beneath it, it's a bit difficult to see exactly what it is. It could be an elongated rose, but actually I'm convinced that it's labia, clitoris, pubic hair, and the white areas to each side are the thighs, white thighs. And there's a banner that streaks across it, which says O for a fa. And when Ken Tynan used the F word on television a year later, questions were asked in the House of Commons. But you know, there was no commentary on it at all at the time. It was like it was just too much.
Female libido was frightening and then despised, which I think is one of the reasons, actually, that Pauline Boaty's work was disappeared, because it absolutely confronted female desire and female lust.
Caroline Kuhn, artist, writer and political activist. Footage of Pauline painting.
I am the 60s. I am pop. I am art. I'm never going to America. But I'll get over that.
Pauline laughing.
If I had to name a painting that was my favourite, would be Love to Paul Belmondo, because it's so expressive of female lust and desire.
Belmondo painted in sunglasses beneath hearts and rose petals.
It's dominated by a huge red rose on top of his head.
The rose was a symbol of female sensuality. She knew what she was doing.
It's a wonderful expression of desire, turning a desiring eye of a female onto a male object of desire. After Pop Goes Easel, she meets Philip Saville, who is a producer and director, a married man. She has an affair with him.
Philip Saville was, I can't think of the word I want to use about him. He was quite glamorous, I think, really, and more sophisticated.
He gets her parts in television programmes. Some of them are quite lowbrow.
I'd like to buy me a drink.
Not much.
You have to drink something if you're going to stay here.
I don't like champagne.
I have to drink it if I'm going to sit with you.
My understanding is that it was quite a controversial move for her peers, you know, for her friends. They were not keen about her getting involved in acting.
I don't think I'm getting through to you.
Oh, when did you last see Norma?
Oh, I ran into her a few weeks ago at the Edwardian Club.
But that's a gambling club, isn't it?
People do gamble in this wicked world.
And also, of course, working with Ken Russell. She appears in Ken Russell's Who Made Pop Goes Easel. But she also appeared, acted in Bartok.
Christopher Gregory, owner and curator of PaulineBoaty.org.
You know, the charisma, it just leaps off the screen, doesn't it?
Everything, when she was on the screen, she totally was captivating, wasn't she? But I don't know if she ever got any decent parts.
The acting part of it, I think, just came along as a result of Pop Goes the Easel.
You made you realise that she could sort of do anything, and she enjoyed it. She enjoyed everything. I think she really loved acting.
She would take on anything, and she was excited and interested. She had a bit part in Alfie.
I was having a beautiful little life, and I couldn't see it. It was this manageress of a dry cleaner.
As Alfie, Michael Caine knocks on a shop window and the smiling manageress, played by Pauline, beckons him inside. He turns the door sign to closed and they kiss, disappearing behind the racks of dry cleaning together. He emerges in a different suit.
And I was getting a suit clean in the bargain. Well, you can't turn something like that down.
Alfie and some of the television films and so on she was in, and also Pop Goes the Easel itself, were kind of easily dismissed as products of that era to a certain extent.
Sunlight through trees and Pauline with a camera.
Lying naked on a chaise lounge whilst the shutter clicks. I'm not acting in my own scene anymore.
One of the things that used to slightly annoy me was Boaty posing sometimes with nothing or very little on in photos. And I sort of thought, she didn't have to do this, did she? And then I realised that's wrong. No, she didn't have to do this. She chose to do this. And of course, she always had her art in the picture as well.
She didn't want to relinquish the right to a sexual identity. You know, she was a beautiful woman and she felt that it was important that women were able to have an autonomous female sexuality on an equal basis with men. With Morley, she posed naked with paintings, but she was acting out very famous old master paintings like Boucher's Louise Murphy, who was the mistress of Louis XIV, and she posed absolutely in that position, but behind her is her painting with Love to John Paul Belmondo.
It was definitely look at me, but it was also look at my work at the same time, which is a very good way of harnessing that. I mean, it's unfortunate that that was the easiest route for her to get her art into photographs.
Michael Ward was another photographer who was sent to take photos, but this time she dressed up as her paintings. So one wonderful picture, she poses with Celia and some of her heroes, dressed as Celia.
There's a lovely picture of the painting and then a picture of Pauline, and I know which one I'd rather look at, and it's Pauline.
Michael Ward put his photographs into an agency. They got bought by Titbits, and the picture editor cut out the paintings so that what we get is just the charming young woman, delectation for a male view.
It's very difficult for us even now to accept that women can be beautiful and charismatic as well as being intelligent and sort of robust academically. We still have the same sexism now, which I experience it. The patriarchy is so strong.
Part of the problem maybe was she was so good looking and that, you know, people wrote about her, you know, forgetting about her art, just her looks maybe got in the way a bit.
While she was abhorrent of it, she was using it. You know, what else would you do? It's like blaming Marilyn Monroe for being a sex symbol. Well, I mean, they promoted her as one and she lived up to it. I think that side of Pauline would not, she didn't want that.
The press kind of represented her in a sort of demeaning way as, you know, a sort of dizzy blonde who was having a go at this and having a go at that. And I've got a wonderful quote that was written, though, in her favour, if I may. It was an article in 1962, quote, "Actresses often have tiny brains. Painters often have large beards. Imagine a brainy actress who is also a painter and also blonde, and you have Pauline Boaty."
Presenter Ronnie Archer Morgan.
I'm still here, waiting on the left, hoping for the revolution to come. It's a man's world. I just hoped it wasn't.
I think her most important work is probably the It's a Man's World diptych.
She's obviously being playful. She's obviously having fun. But the title says it all. It's a man's world.
It's, first of all, it's brilliantly political. And secondly, it is the world as Boaty saw it, seen through men's eyes. So when men see men, they see war and power and politics, and they see fame, Marcello Mastroianni, Cassius Clay. And when the world is looked at by the same men looking at women, they see available sexual figures, effectively.
These are probably at once people that Boaty respects and admires, but people she also fears and is concerned about. And there's this whole kind of subtext of we'll never really know what Boaty thought about any of these as individuals. But the fact that she brings them together in this collective group kind of says it all. It's a man's world. This is a woman painting these men. They'll always have more power than she has, even though she conjured them into her picture.
There's the rows in the one full of men, crowded out by the men. And in the one of the women, the second part of the diptych, there is that extraordinary headless figure, which is actually not very sexual. The others are all, I assume, that she's painted photographs from pornographic material. But this one in the middle here is just this headless, slightly sexless, but there's a genuine female torso. And it's such a brilliant bit of political painting.
Man's World 1 and Man's World 2 just encapsulate everything that she was at her very young age expressing in politics, life and art.
She was sort of representing the sexuality of women from a woman's point of view.
I am able to exist in the world in a way that Boaty couldn't even have imagined. And actually, I owe her a huge debt of gratitude. And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm such an advocate for her painting.
She wasn't wagging her finger. She wasn't kind of, you know, being angry and po-faced all the time. She was also, you know, jiving with the best of them, twisting with the best of them, but also a very serious feminist at the same time. And I think that comes through in the work, and again, would have come through in the work much more. I mean, feminism really blossomed in the late 60s into the 70s. Who knows?
Hockney made really important work about the gay space, about queer culture. And Pauline was making really particular work about sexism. You know, it's very proto-feminist. Don't forget, this is the 60s. So I'm talking about it as feminist work. But actually, Boaty didn't have the framework of feminism, of feminist art history, of all of those scholars in which to place her work. She was kind of a very singular voice. You know, she said a really powerful thing, like, women are raging in this country. People were really terrified of what she was saying. You have to understand, like, what a kind of repressed, conservative world that she was operating in.
BBC's The Public Ear.
A revolution is on the way, and it's partly because we no longer take our standards from the tweedy top. All over the country, young girls are sprouting, shouting and shaking. And if they terrify you, they mean to.
She was so consciously aware of women's place in culture and society and in the organisation of hierarchy. And so you could call her a proto-feminist because we didn't have the language yet.
I think the monologues absolutely anchor her feminist analysis. It's not something that we're imposing on her from the present.
You see, the implicit assumption in all these stories is that all girls work only until they catch their man, and not one of the married heroines has a job outside the home. Husband and children is the career to end all careers. One actress abandons her career for, and I quote, the much more exciting job of wife and mother.
She basically was going to live her life the way she wanted to live it, and she wasn't going to be told how to how to act out any aspect of her life, really.
I am all there on the canvas. Humming. Closer still. You'll see magic if you open your eyes.
I think a key sort of painting in this link between the absolute celebration of pleasure and a critique of the gendered landscape that the 60s presented her with is Portrait of Derek Marlowe with Unknown Ladies.
It looks like a piece of fan painting. You know, like he's there, black and white, charismatic, so cool. And then there are these women behind him and they're in this kind of like stained glass formation, which is, you know, really shows how innovative she was. And the women look like, I don't know, kind of glamorous pinups behind him. But as you get a bit closer and their faces are kind of blurred, they're quite garish, the makeup's quite dreadful, and you realise they're totally anonymous, like totally unindividual, and he's the singular star. So I think it's a great painting about fame, it's a great painting about the status of women. And I love the fact that it looks so joyful and it looks so pure pop. And then underneath it, there's this actually really kind of dark narrative about the position of women, about the kind of anonymity of these heavily made up women compared to this kind of like easy, effortless man.
She was having a like a knowing wink, but at the same time, what she was saying was true. I mean, she was saying that, but in a way that would maybe slip under and make more of a point and a lasting point than if she'd been really, you know, hitting you with one of her placards.
Yeah, I think she was a feminist, but I think there's a... I mean, she was definitely a feminist, but there's an interesting re-evaluation that's gone on in the past kind of 10 years that says, don't just file her under feminism, because she's actually bigger than that. She's a pop art artist, she's a feminist artist, but she's also just an artist. She's saying more than just feminism or pop art. You know, she has a wider vocabulary than that.
She's very intellectual, Pauline. You know, she wasn't just a dumb blonde by any means.
She was very involved with the New Left. An icon of hope was Cuba and the Cuban Revolution, and she made paintings about that.
She was in the vanguard of her time, fighting for the future, like her male colleagues were in their time, fighting for the working class, fighting for the politics of their time.
Her work was just becoming more political. But yes, she also did reflect the world around her, the Profumo scandal. She wasn't just all fluffy and flowers and hearts.
She had that propensity towards having a bar at the top of the frame. And I was looking at it and thinking, with Christine Keeler on the chair there, with a blood-red background, and Profumo and the others at the top in blue, and I was thinking, what does it remind me of? And then it occurred to me, that's the same design layout as a newspaper, the front page of a newspaper. There's the masthead here. The masthead here has got the conservative authority figures in it, in blue. And below it, there's Christine Keeler occupying this enormous space with this crimson background. Maybe the Scarlet Woman, maybe it's saying we're against the establishment or something like that. It looked like this was a piece of bad news that those people at the top could not avoid.
Another important painting is Countdown to Violence, which is like the other side of the coin of 5-4-3-2-1, which is counting down to the joys of the weekend. Countdown to Violence is about male violence. We have the assassination of Lincoln and of Kennedy. We have looking at Vietnam with the monk that self-immolated, set fire to himself. But interestingly, there's a hand descending with secateurs and it is cutting off the red rose that represents female sensibility. So it's very much about male violence.
As long as I have you beside me, the fear leaves my body every time they put out the light.
Happily, she met Clive Goodwin, and we all liked Clive Goodwin. He was the sweetest man. And he was, what was his job? He was a literary agent.
They came down here one weekend, all terribly happy. Said, we're getting married on Monday. And we were a bit aghast, you know. And she said, if you tell Mum, she said, I won't talk to you again. She didn't want to know, she didn't want a fuss.
a whirlwind romance. She came and she said to me, "Nat, what are you doing on Monday?" Because I thought she wanted me to feed the cat or something. And she said, "Would you and Eric be witnesses at my wedding?" And I was, "What?" So we were. Here we are, witnesses at the wedding.
There was a photo in one of the evening papers of them getting married. And Nana phoned up and said, "You knew, didn't you?" And I said, "Yes, I'm terribly sorry I did." And she came 6 months later and I said, "You know, it broke my heart." And she said, "I realise that now." And we were back on tack again. The next time they came down and said she was pregnant. But she said, "They found a lump in my breast. I've got to go to hospital tomorrow."
Bridget Boatie, sister-in-law.
"I'm young and vibrant and floating downstream. My whole life's behind me."
Natalie Gibson.
"Well, I just remember her being in hospital and she had a pile of books by her bed and she was reading, you know, everything about what she thought she had and thought it would take 10 years off her life.
She didn't take any radiation or anything. She wouldn't have it because of the baby, which I quite admire her about, I must admit.
I can remember going to see her in hospital with Clive and she had a little black spot here, like a pinprick. And when we left, I said to him, what was that black mark? I mean, I was pretty naive, actually, because the Royal Marsden is known as a cancer hospital. And he didn't answer me. And I know why now, obviously, because it was bad news.
Ken Tynan, you know, Ken Tynan, the great theatre critic at the time, wrote a piece. I think I always tell people it's the Evening Standard. And that was, it was like, good news. Pauline Boatie, who was in hospital for cancer, is in recovery. She's getting much better. A lie. But Pauline read that.
One day I was having lunch at the Royal College and I was just going to see Pauline. And Peter was there in the senior common room and I said, "I'm going to see Pauline. Do you want to come with me?" And she just died before we got there.
And she died 10 minutes earlier. So I just missed her.
Sir Peter Blake. Pauline Boatie died on the 1st of July 1966, just 4.5 months after the birth of her daughter, Boatie Goodwin.
I think she'd have quite liked being a mother. I honestly think I do. I don't think she'd have stopped painting. She might have stopped kind of going round with the crowd that she was in because of it.
Pauline Boatie's paints and paint box are shown, courtesy of Caroline Kuhn.
In the months leading up to her death, she was still working. You know, she was drawing and she made a fabulous painting, Bum.
Bum's just delightful, isn't it? I mean, yes, she did know she was dying at this point. So as a final gesture, as you leave the room, is to flash an arse at everybody. It's just brilliant. It's so funny. It's so vivacious, isn't it? It's such a great thing to do. And also it's a bum under a proscenium arch, you know, so it was actually going bum on stage, you know? I gather her thinking there was that because O Calcutta was a pun on quel culta, what a bum you've got, that she went, okay, bum, great. And also the word bum, it's not needed on there, is it? I mean, we all know what we're looking at, but just to go, I tell you what, I'm gonna just ram it home a bit further, you know? I'm gonna give you a huge bum, bum.
The idea originally was she was going to do a series of erogenous zones, but she only got to doing the bum, which is a fabulous painting. And it shows her right at the heart of the zeitgeist, still absolutely there, at the cutting edge.
Ashes to ashes, dusk to dusk. You can leave now if you must. No one will try and stop you.
The death seems to sit there like a... like that's her story, and it's not her story because the thing about her work is that it is so very alive, you know. It's even bum, you know, that's a very living image.
You could look at the story of Pauline Boatie's life and say, you know, it's overshadow, everything is overshadowed by her tragically early death. It's also, what really inspires me is how much she managed to achieve in that time.
Pop art was kind of in its infancy when Pauline was alive. You know, she died so young, she died at 28. And actually the books were all being written sort of 10, 20 years after her death. And so if there wasn't noise and activity about that practice, then there's no one to kind of carry the torch for her.
The art world, like music and fashion and anything, it comes and goes. It has peaks and troughs and it dips in and out of things. And the pop art that Pauline did probably went through quite a long period of not being pop, of being unpopular. But it's just fashions, it's just style, you know. People are always looking for the new thing. And then after a while, they'll go back to the old thing.
You make a mark on the 60s like she did and then just go completely forgotten. Someone is going to come after it eventually.
Pauline smiling.
I really don't mind if you forget me. You just didn't realise.
Natalie reads a postcard she was sent by Boaty Goodwin.
I'd like to talk to you about Pauline's work. You see, I have around 15 paintings at my grandfather's, which all look great. I was wanting to sound out the possibility of an exhibition of some sort. I wondered if you had any ideas.
Thank God the work was all right in the barn. It hadn't been eaten by mice or, you know, made into kindling or something. You know, I mean, it's a miracle it survived intact.
It was shown at the Barbican in an exhibition in 1993.
I think a lot of Pauline's stuff was stored, or most of her pop art was almost certainly in the attic before Pauline died. They weren't being looked after and the paintings were just stacked up one after another. And we put them out in an old... It was a more modern building that didn't let the rain in. But it was outside and forgot about.
These paintings came in and they were dirty. They had bits of straw hanging out of them. I mean, it's lucky some cows hadn't even trampled over them. So they must have been upright against a wall. And that's the only thing they did to sort of help preserve them, is to stand them up. It was a delight to get because you were getting some rough old stuff and you're transforming it. We didn't reframe anything. We left everything in its original frame.
There was an exhibition at Mayer Gallery and Whitford Fine Art in 98. It was the first full exhibition of her work, and the Tate bought their first work from that exhibition, which was The Only Blondie in the World. They had also reserved the Belmondo and It's a Man's World 1, but they decided not to buy them. At that point, the paintings were selling for 20,000 each, so they could have had, or a little more, they could have had all three paintings for around 60,000.
Bum sold in 2017 for over 600,000, then in 2022 with Love to John Paul Belmondo sold for 1.1 million, and in 2024, Epitaph to Something's Gotta Give sold for 1.3 million.
I am the 60s. I am art. You just stood there mesmerised.
George Lionel Barker, Sales Director, Gazelli Gallery.
You know, Pauline Boaty is this very mythical creature. And when you're in the art world bubble, you don't really know how big it is. Does this extend beyond the walls of the gallery, or is this a real, you know, internal group of dedicated people that are interested in her work? It's the first time that we have organised a complete solo show of Pauline's work. It's a big deal for us. You know, it's been a few years in the making, and we're really just trying to drive a big audience and make people aware of Pauline's work and her story.
It's just really sad, isn't it? You have to die and be dead for 30 years and then somebody will take notice of you. But at least her artwork is in the world where people can see and enjoy it, and at least people do know who she is now.
Her time was the 60s, but her time could be any time, really, because of the enduring relevance of what she did. And, of course, because she died young, she will always be young and beautiful. And that has to be acknowledged, she was very beautiful.
I just think it's such a bloody tragedy that it takes so long for these figures to get recognised. And I just hope that, you know, she will be properly implanted in the history of pop art and the history of British painting in her rightful place.
You know, the fact that she was out there protesting about the ugly new buildings coming up, the dancing on Ready, Steady, Go, the radio programme, the art. I mean, it's just an astonishing legacy that she's left behind, really.
She was playing around with possibly being an actress, being a painter, being a political animal for women's rights. She was pretty intellectual in a way.
She'd done more than most people do in a lifetime, really.
She was a complete package.
Oh, I think she should be remembered as a very interesting and original pop artist.
I think she is one of those meteors, isn't she? You know, she burns briefly but very brightly, and we're still marvelling at the flames, you know, that she produced, really.
Film footage shows Pauline reaching for an alarm clock on a bedside table. Jenny Eclair, comedian, writer and actress.
The potential was so fabulous, and she was so in tune with her time. And her story was just prematurely cut short.
A vibrant, joyful, potentially very, very happy woman.
Just a spark of light, a force of nature, an inspiration.
Exuberant and bold and opinionated and beautiful and hilarious and serious and knowledgeable and knowing.
For me, Pauline Boadsey is a proto-feminist painter who ripped up the rule book. She presents pop art in a staggeringly original way, and it feels so relevant today.
The only female pop artist of her, British pop artist of her day.
She was a firework, wasn't she? She lit up everything and was brilliant and sparkled and twinkled, and then...
She may be dead, but the art is still alive and doing what all good art does, make us think about the world both then and now.
I kind of think to myself at 81, what would she be like? I mean, she'd have a lovely figure still, and her face would still probably be quite pretty, wouldn't it? I mean, she'd still have the eyes, and she'd look after herself almost certainly. And it would have been nice to see her and Clive grow old, but that isn't to be, and that's life, isn't it?
Clive Goodwin, devastated by the loss of Pauline, never remarried. He fell ill on a 1978 business trip to Los Angeles at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. Staff assumed Goodwin was drunk and called the police. He was handcuffed and taken to the station, where he passed away alone in a cell. His autopsy found no trace of alcohol or drugs. After Pauline's death, her daughter Boaty Godwin was initially raised by Pauline's parents before moving to live with her father at age 5. She was 11 when Clive died. After a long legal battle, Boaty won substantial damages for Clive's wrongful death. In the late 1980s, she earned a degree and a master's at the California Institute of Arts. The night after her master's show, Boaty died from an accidental heroin overdose at 29.